Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. Before we get into this week's show, I just want to let you know that there will be no podcast next week. I am off to the United States for the big Las Vegas week. And I'll just mostly be catching up with people, to be honest. So to all of the listeners who are going to be there, I'll see you around. No show next week. But there is a show this week, and I think it's a pretty good one. In this week's feature interview, I speak with the Australian Prime Minister's cybersecurity advisor, Alastair McGibbon, about what it is that the Australian government is pushing for in terms of industry cooperation around surveillance. There's been a lot of hype on this one. Al Mack joins the show to work through some of it. And honestly, Australia's push at the moment is the sort of thing I think you can expect to see more of around the world. So I do think this is an interview of global relevance. This week's show is brought to you by Remediant. Remediant makes a product that's really designed to make lateral movement through a network much harder. Essentially, it's a way to restrict all privileged accounts on your infrastructure until you actually need it. So instead of just being able to log into your production environment, you can set this thing up so you have to enable the privilege you need for a set period of time. It's a different approach to privilege management than things like password vaults. So if you work in an authentication group, you're going to want to hear what they have to say. Remediant's chief executive, Tim Keeler, joins the show for this week's sponsor interview. But before we get into all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, it turns out we were a little bit wrong about Alpha Bay pulling an exit scam. It's less happy news for the operators of Alpha Bay, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it looks like one of the other options, which is that law enforcement had gone after them, appears to be what has happened. And then, I guess to kind of compound that, one of the founders of Alpha Bay, who'd been picked up by the police in Thailand, apparently living there for some years with a Thai wife, etc., was recently found dead in his jail cell. They're saying suicide. I guess if you were looking down the barrel of, you know, the sort of thing that Ross Ulbricht got, then maybe that would be a thing you'd consider. But yeah, it's just... I guess he exited, but it's not the sort of exit scam that that people were expecting, unfortunately.
Look, it's a pretty unfortunate thing when a young person takes their life, of course. But this guy, Alexandre Cazes, who's Canadian, he had been living in Bangkok, living the life, you know, Lambos, nice big house, the whole thing. He was arrested by Thailand's Narcotics Suppression Bureau, and it looks like he was going to be extradited over to the United States. And it looks like he killed himself the day that he was arrested. So, yeah, he didn't sail off into the sunset with everyone's Bitcoin. It looks like a, much unhappier ending. And no word yet on further arrests.
No, we haven't seen any other details. Of course, people will be wondering where all the Bitcoins went, because there were, of course, quite a lot of movement of Bitcoins. Whether those are going to show up in, you know, an FBI auction in a couple of years, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, clearly the story is unfolding, and there was a bunch of law enforcement, you know, coordinated law enforcement action around the place based on the FBI rolling up Alpha Bay.
Yeah, a lot of the people watching this say that the way that those Bitcoin wallets have been drained doesn't fit the profile of law enforcement activity, right? So maybe, in this case, it's a little bit in column A, a little bit in column B, you know, an arrested admin and the rest of them burned it down and racked off with the money, which, seems like a reasonable working scenario. Moving on to some blockbuster news by the Washington Post. They are claiming that the United Arab Emirates actually orchestrated the hacking of these Qatari government websites. Now, we spoke about this previously when CNN had claimed that this was a Russian thing. But now it looks like the blame has shifted, at least, in the reporting, to the UAE. And of course, all of these websites were hacked and false statements attributed to the Qatari leader, which sort of sparked this crisis. So now, the blame is heading in a different direction.
Yeah, no, this is certainly, I was going to say it's a twist, but I guess it's not exactly a surprise that this might be what have happened. There's a number of angles to it. Like, one is that the Washington Post is attributing these claims to sources in the U.S. intelligence apparatus.
Which is exactly who CNN attributed their reporting to say that it was Russia, right, by.
Yeah, exactly. Although, of course, I mean, it could absolutely be, Russian private contractors, doing work for the UAE, and maybe that would explain some of the, same sources and methods or whatever. But, that's an interesting twist. And then combined with – you know, the sort of two-faced U.S. foreign policy in the region at the moment, like with Donald Trump being, you know, sort of outspoken pro-Saudi, anti-Qatari, and then...
And then someone reminded him that they actually have a, you know, U.S. military presence in Qatar, and he's like, oops.
Exactly right. And then, yeah, Tillerson's, you know, got on the other side of the fence trying to, you know, play diplomacy between the between all the parties involved. And it really illustrates more than anything what a mess U.S. policy in the region is. But, yeah, it's got a ratchet up the tension. I mean, I guess it's already well ratcheted, right, between Qatar and its neighbors. And then, yeah, I mean, seeing this kind of hacking being used for, you know, such straightforward geopolitics is, well, it's a sign of the times, isn't it?
It is. Now, it's become just another headline, you know, this would have been huge.
And imagine if, you know, we'd had this headline 5-10 years ago. Imagine what a much bigger story it would have been.
Yeah.
And the fact that this is just every day now. I guess it's sad. I don't know. It's weird. Strange world we live in.
It's interesting, though, because the Russia thing, you know, I always sort of wondered about that because, you know, one of the charges leveled against Qatar is it was too cozy with Iran, which is, of course, an ally of Russia. So, yeah, you know, I do not claim to understand the first thing about Middle Eastern politics, which seems to be the most confusing thing I've ever approached, right? Now, look, when the NotPetya thing went down, you know, we did mention that Maersk, the global logistics and shipping firm, had been pretty severely impacted by this, and other logistics firms as well, including like TNT Express, which is owned by FedEx. And, you know, believe it or not, they are still having an awful time trying to get systems back online and trying to get these, you know, things actually delivered. This is crazy, right? Because we're a long way past it now, and this is still a rolling issue affecting global shipping and global deliveries.
Yeah, it is. These firms which have, you know, necessarily for their business a global footprint, getting compromised, you know, in one country for one country's political, you know, sort of conflicts, and then having it propagate up and down their network is, I guess, really, you know, that's a lesson that perhaps some global firms need to take on board, and how much of an impact this has had. I mean, Maersk put out a statement the last few days saying that, you know, some of their EDI platforms that give people updates about their shipping and all that kind of stuff are only just coming back online. TNT are saying that they've actually... maybe irreversibly lost some of the data that they actually don't have backups of, which, I mean, that's clearly another thing they're going to be learning. But yeah, that's the fact that we're seeing this, you know, what is it, like a month past now? It's a sign of how much impact that had, and presumably impact that, you know, the Russians behind it didn't actually intend. I mean, you know, I can't imagine that this was what they thought was going to happen, you know, compared to all the other things that could have gone wrong in Ukraine as a result.
And just think of all of the organizations that rely on these global logistics firms to actually get, you know, to manage their supply chain. Like, I'm hearing that the FedEx component of this is causing all sorts of headaches for Apple, right? Particularly when things moving in and out of China. So, I mean, the question that springs to mind is, firstly, is this having an impact on global economic growth? And, you know, secondly, how much worse would it need to be for it to have an actual measurable impact on global economic growth? This is actually a much bigger deal than I think people realize.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an indicator of how important sort of, you know, just-in-time logistics is to modern business. And yeah, it is a much bigger thing than perhaps people gave it credit for. And yeah, it's a good question. Like, at what point would we have to consider our response to something like this that had a side effect that was, you know, actually bad on a global scale? And, you know, the NotPetya thing rolled over so very, very quickly, and people focused so much on the faux ransomware aspect. But yeah, we didn't really, you know, we haven't really seen a good discussion of what the, you know, consequences of that ought to be.
Now, look, you know, staying on the topic, Lloyd's of London, which is, of course, one of the world's largest insurers, has released a report saying that a well-executed, quote-unquote, cyber attack could cause damage in the order of $121.4 billion. I love that they've got the .4 there. You know, I mean, we're talking about billions of dollars, but no rounding, just rounding to the nearest 100 million. $121.4 billion. And they walk through a few scenarios that they say could actually cause this sort of damage.
Yeah, and of course, anytime you see a headline like that, I'm immediately skeptical, as you say, like the point four.
Well, me too, but we just spoke about those two stories, right? So this is why I'm finding it interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I guess the two scenarios they came up with, one of which is sort of an activist-led campaign to disrupt a very big cloud service provider like Amazon, and the second being sort of like a WannaCry-style mass vulnerability attack, and they, you know, pull some numbers out of their wherever they pull numbers out of. And yeah, like I'm surprised that it's only 100 billion. I'm sure you could do worse than that if your goal was to actually cause economic damage and you were, you know, well-resourced, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, obviously the numbers are kind of made up, but clearly the number is non-zero and big, which is the important thing. 100 billion plus or minus 500 billion, you know, like whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we live in interesting times. Krebs on Security is carrying a story. Look, a bunch of outlets have reported on this. Everyone's freaking out over something called GSOAP. What is it?
So yeah, there's a vulnerability in one of the open source libraries that provides SOAP, like web services communications, that's used in a lot of embedded systems. Stephen Ridley's CrowdSend Rio found a pretty sweet like Stack Overflow bug in it that you can use for remote code exec. Minor caveat being you have to overflow a signed 32-bit integer buffer, which is so like 2 gig big. But overflow at code exec, and of course, lots of embedded systems use this particular piece of code, and in particular Axis security cameras, which are quite widely deployed as one of them. Axis appear to be patching, but lots of other vendors, of course, are a little bit less responsive. But yeah, potentially, you know, it has some options for, you know, IoT worming, but the nature of the bug is not quite as easy as, you know, guessing default creds like we saw with Mirai or that kind of thing. So perhaps we won't see a planet melting worm out of it. But yeah, Internet of Things continues to deliver horrid, rubbish 90s bugs.
We've got an interesting write-up from Bleeping Computer here about, I think it's an issue that we're going to have to watch, which is all of these orphaned Chrome extensions, you know, that might have decent install bases. Like, they're getting acquired by developers who just immediately turn them into adware, right? This is going to be a problem.
Yeah, it's an interesting example of, and I think you're right, it will become a much wider sort of approach to compromising people. Like, take a piece of software that has a largely deployed user base, be it end user software like browser extensions in this case, or be it, you know, kind of components that are used elsewhere. Like, we've seen people compromise like the Node Package Manager and other bits and pieces where there are library software that are very, very widespread. But yeah, taking those over either illicitly or through just buying them, as happened in this case, and then trojaning them. In this particular write-up, it was a Chrome plugin that provided some like user interface extensions for YouTube, and the guy abandoned the project because YouTube was changing its UI and he wanted to start afresh, and then someone approached him and offered to buy it. They bought it, and then they immediately turned it into adware and then trojaned everybody who had previously installed the extension, which is, you know, kind of a skeezy thing to do. And it turns out this particular company has done it to a bunch of different Chrome extensions.
Look, it's skeezy, but it's a hell of a business model. Like, you know.
Yeah. Good lateral thinking. But yeah, I mean, you could absolutely see the same sort of thing, like go around and take over, you know, abandoned SourceForge accounts or anywhere where the software supply chain can be kind of bought and then, you know, repurposed. That's clearly a bug, you know, an approach to compromise or approach to doing things that people will, you know, learn from this particular one and apply elsewhere.
Yeah, speaking of orphaned websites and you know, orphaned apps and websites, Motherboard's carrying an interesting story about how easy it is to own people's old abandoned MySpace accounts because they've got password recovery for people who might not have the original email address they were using in like 2003 or whatever, right? So that's an interesting story that's in this week's show notes as well. A bit of drama in the cryptocurrency world. CoinDash had what they call an ICO, an initial coin offering, didn't quite go to plan.
Oh dear. Right. So they were selling a whole bunch of Ethereum to fund their ongoing trading platform development or whatever. And they had this initial coin offering where people were going to buy in. And like on the minute that they went live with this, somebody logged into their WordPress, presumably using access they'd obtained previously, and just changed the destination like wallet address and made off with like $8 million worth of Ethereum, like 37,000 Ether, made off with $8 million worth.
I really do wonder why we bother working for a living. When I read stories this, I'm like, you know, you mean we are one compromised WordPress blog away from like $8 million bucks.
I know. We're in the wrong business, eh? We are. Just go do that. But it's all right. It's all right. CoinDash have said they have started an internet forensic investigation to figure out who's wrong, and they have contacted law enforcement.
Yes, well, I'm sure they'll.
Exactly what happens in the libertarian dream future that you signed up for, right? That you can just phone the police because, like, they totally exist in your libertarian future. Yeah.
anyway, we've got a bug that's worth mentioning here. WebEx, which, you know, has had all sorts of hideous, like, properly horrible, you know, one-line arbitrary code execution violence. Tavis Ormandy found another one in a WebEx extension, which is a horror show. And if you use WebEx, you should really not use WebEx, basically. I think it's safe to say that it's not safe software.
No, and especially, like, if you're just using, like, the bare web interface, maybe. But, yeah, the browser extensions for Chrome and Firefox in this particular case, how to get another remote code exec in them, I would strongly consider not running, especially the fat client bit of WebEx on anything you care about, because that's just not a good thing. But, yeah, loads of people do, and it's good that Tavis is wrecking a few more bugs in that particular software. But Cisco's fix is not exactly satisfactory. They're still, like, one XSS away from RC in everybody's boxes. So
that was what happened with the last one. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just indeed. Now, look, I want to talk. It's kind of a light week for news, to be honest, but I want to talk about this rant that a friend of ours posted. His name is Thoth or Finbar, and he's a very smart fellow, and he has written a post called "The Cyber Kill Chain is Making Us Dumber." And it's a high quality rant, I got to say. And it is doing the rounds. You know, I've seen it being spoken about by all sorts of people. I find it pretty funny, to be honest. I mean, it mostly takes aim at this concept of the cyber kill chain as not really making a whole bunch of sense. It doesn't really map that well onto reality, is his point. Now, I know that you don't necessarily agree with the gist.
Yeah, so I mean, I think his criticism absolutely has valid points. I mean, the whole militarization of terminology in this industry is not a net benefit for us. And the, you know, Lockheed Martin cyber kill chain TM makes me want to throw up in my mouth. And I don't disagree with that bit. And his assertion that their initial breakdown of the steps of the kind of kill chain thing, you know, I also agree with some of the criticism there. I guess the thing that I disagreed with is that there is no value to this. You know, this discussion of a kill chain, because in my opinion, the thing that, you know, people for whom the kill chain and other, you know, trademarked infographics are designed for, really the thing they need to take away from it is that there is more to, you know, getting hacked than the computer hacking bit. Like, the last stage of the kill chain is the action on objectives bit. And that's the thing that, you know, I guess I wanted people to take out of a kill chain. Like, if you're an executive or someone who doesn't understand cyber.
So this is like you look at this, the cyber kill chain and associated ridiculous infographics that he's managed to publish so many of these,
collection of them.
And they're awful, right? So your thesis seems to be that this is a handy little puppet show for executives to sort of understand the gist.
Yeah. Well, I guess it explains to them that hacking is to do something. Like, as far as their problems are concerned, like, for so many people, it's just like, there's computer hacking, it's bleep bloop cyber stuffs, and they don't have to think about it anymore.
So this is a step down the path to a more meaningful understanding.
Yeah. Well, I'm also the idea that attackers do more than one thing, right? They do a whole bunch of things, and whether that's a chain or a loop or a cycle or a, you know, whatever the shape the infographic takes, it's kind of not so relevant. The point is that attackers do a whole bunch of things, and then the outcome is they decide to do something bad to you. And for most people, that's not an actual logical conclusion to reach, that people would do hacking in order to actually do something that matters. So I feel like it has some value, even if it doesn't need a trademark on the end.
I would still recommend people read this post, though. What do you think?
It's totally worth reading, though. Like, yeah. Even just for the great collection of infographics.
I like his ideal operational life cycle chart, which includes a shark. Which is quite cool. Very cool.
That is actually the best of the diagrams, yes, apart from the, like, jumble of cables, which is probably what it actually looks like.
Now, look, speaking of rants, this Sunday I was stuck at home. My lovely lady was down with a cold, so I stayed at home, and I used some of that time to write up a piece. What I was trying to do is reassure people, I guess, that when governments talk about better cooperation between, you know, tech companies and law enforcement, they're not talking about making Facebook downgrade WhatsApp to single DES encryption, right? That was kind of the point of what I wrote up. And I said, well, hey, like, WhatsApp, for example, they back up user messages. It might be end-to-end, but they back up their users' messages. That's an option. So they could hand over backups of the messages. Now, if your target doesn't happen to use backups, maybe they could just turn backups on for them. Do you know what I mean? Like, twiddling a few defaults per user might not actually be that difficult. So the whole thing was, like, this was supposed to be a bit of a think piece, but it blew up, right? And it's done the rounds, and it's being cited by, like, the Lowy Institute and think tanks and stuff, right? So... and really criticized by the pitchfork wielding pro crypto masses, right? I'm curious, what did you think of this piece, Adam?
I thought it was a good piece. I thought that it summarized the debate in a much more sane way than we've seen. And I think that it was a, I think basically you're right. And certainly the interview you're going to run with Al McGibbon, he makes pretty compelling arguments that line up with yours. And indeed, he cites your piece as being a good one. So, yeah, I think I basically agree with you, despite being, essentially a 90s, reformed 90s cypherpunk myself. I think your piece. I'm glad it's being cited by think tanks and stuff, because it's a much more sensible take than we're seeing elsewhere.
Now, look, for what it's worth, I don't know if this is really the direction we're heading in. And in the piece, I say that, look, eventually they might go to Apple and say, hey, can you iCloud this guy's entire device? Here's a warrant. Do you know what I mean? So there might be some sort of, they might eventually go down the path of insisting on some sort of design requirement like that. Or, hey, we need a shell on this person's device. Can you push some sort of sneaky Fedware onto their device and give us access to that? Now, the reason that I want to push the debate in this direction is because I don't want to see what you fear, which is some sort of lawenforcementgateway.apple.com, where the feds can just, pick a device and then own it, right? Which is kind of what we've seen with Kalia, like in the case of wiretaps on telephone networks. They are hideously insecure. I don't want to see that. Where do you think we could wind up on this, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think the logical approach of something that will actually work long term is for the vendors to provide some kind of mechanism for law enforcement to push out a Trojan to individual devices. I think the approach of doing app level specifics, like WhatsApp backups or something, I don't know that that's scalable, just because every app's going to be different. It's going to be fiddly to keep right. It makes sense that it's a thing you would build into the core operating system, and Apple and Google and Microsoft would just provide an interface where you could load a Fedware shim into the device, and what it does is kind of up to the individual jurisdiction, and it's not really the vendor's business to figure that out. Then you have to be able to provide a way to do that that is, relatively targeted, controlled, has warrant, has oversight, and doesn't result in weakening everybody's devices all the time, that doesn't result in being able to reuse that capability against devices outside of the scope of the individual warrants, and that doesn't provide mass surveillance. And I think that's one of the things that we haven't distinguished between well in these debates is the difference between individual targeted surveillance and mass surveillance. And, the sort of one of the concerns of the crypto pitchfork crowd is that you'd be able to do mass surveillance. And obviously governments don't have a great track record for not using their powers for, mass metadata surveillance and, kind of pattern of life style stuff. But that's also one of the differences between, a law enforcement, domestic law enforcement focused capability and international foreign intelligence sort of military function, which is kind of is a different kettle of fish, I suppose. I think a capability where law enforcement can log in and Trojan individual devices is where we're going to end up, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I wouldn't like to see the law enforcement actually being able to do that without the cooperation of the tech firms. Do you know what I mean? No way would I like to see any authority, FBI, NSA, doesn't matter who it is, no way would I like to see them be able to provision the access without having to hand over a warrant to the tech firm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like, that's an awful idea.
Yeah, and I think that would be a thing that we would want to see in this process, is that there is a gateway they have to go through where they have to submit an actual written warrant, an actual lawyer actually looks at it, that it's not a fully automated process. Because obviously, I have to trust by virtue of running an Apple device, I have to trust Apple in my supply chain, but I don't trust you know, the New Zealand law enforcement, for example, to keep control of their credentials to, you know, lawful intercept gateway on apple.com or whatever. So yeah, there needs to be a manual step in the process, and there needs to be some agreement on how we do oversight, right? And what sort of statistics get published, that kind of thing, so that we can not have it turn into dragnet surveillance. And also, well, that there is some, you know,
the oversight opportunities available to you when the tech companies are part of the process are actually substantial, right? Because you can have some sort of ombudsman that deals with the tech companies and can track down individual, individual cases where access has been provisioned. But I guess what's interesting here is we've moved beyond the talk already, just in this conversation, of whether or not this means weakening devices for everyone, because that to me seems a bit of a red herring. And I think it's possible to do this with the cooperation of the tech firms to provide, you know, law enforcement with access to devices. I think that's no longer a question. I think the interesting question is that something we want to do? And I actually don't think the government is pushing in that direction just yet. I think what they want to do is go for cooperation on things that can be done now and then see how far that gets them, right? But you take my point, don't you, that the conversation about whether or not this is possible is a dumb one. The conversation should be about whether or not this is something we should do and what the oversight and circumstances look like when it's done.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's possible to do it. Whether we want to do it, I think, you know, certainly we in the liberal West have already decided that it's a thing that we're doing. Like, we have lawful intercept of telecommunications already. Clearly, it's just an extension to kind of stop this being, to stop the going dark thing. But, I don't know that the government knows what they want yet. And Alma Gibbon makes a pretty good point in the interview that you're going to hear soon, you know, that right now, just solving the problem of we have an iPhone that we've, you know, physically acquired in a search warrant and we can't unlock it. Like, even just solving that problem would make them happier than they are now. And, you know, as you say, they're going for things that are, you know, what can they do right now that buys them a few years and then 5 years, 10 years down the track, we're going to be in a position where, you know, every commercial operating system has a built-in remote access capability for law enforcement, you know, which is terrifying, but, you know, it's kind of a logical consequence of having strong crypto and having devices that are no longer trivially ownable. You know, that's how we got here.
That is exactly the point, right? And what's interesting, I've had an interesting journey the last few days because, you know, this podcast and stuff that I write, I mean, it's consumed by a really diverse bunch of people. There are NatSec people, policy people who listen to this show and read the stuff that we might post on risky.biz. Then there are also the people who are very, very fearful of that first group of people. Do you know what I mean? And then there's the bulk of the audience is sort of what I'd call the working hackers, right? Who might not like that this is the direction that we're heading in, but they at least appreciate the analysis, right? So it's a really polarizing issue, and trying to serve the totality of the audience for this podcast has actually been pretty difficult when dealing with this topic.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, right. I'm afraid that I'm going to get shanked in an IRC channel, you know, after saying that this seemed like a sensible approach to the problem. You know, all the crypto people will be all up in my business, you know, and challenging.
You're going to get cyber shanked.
I am. I'm totally going to get cyber shanked.
All right. Well, let's get on to that interview. So let's cap off the news. Adam, thank you very much for joining us, as always, to have a chat about the news. And I'll chat to you again in 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, I'll look forward and we'll hear all of the Vegas stories when you get back.
Big thanks to Adam for that. As I'd mentioned earlier and during the news, there is no show next week, but I did post another Soapbox edition yesterday, a Soapbox podcast, which is actually really interesting. It's all about automated attack simulation platforms that you can use to validate your existing security controls. And yeah, I think if you're someone who spends a bunch of money on security kit in your organization, you at least want to examine this approach, right? Because it's interesting stuff. So just go to the website, risky.biz, or scroll back in the podcast feed and you will find that podcast. Okay, now you just heard us talking about this whole issue of the Australian government pushing for more cooperation with industry. This is something that they were talking about very strongly at the G20 meeting, the most recent G20 meeting. And you just heard a bit of a recap of the piece that I wrote, which, you know, is published on the website. Now, again, I don't think they're going to go that far with this batch of legislation. And, you know, maybe people do need to calm down just a couple of notches. I do understand that people get twitchy when the government starts talking about changes to the law that impact privacy. And that is completely fair enough. But I got to say, I think this meme that the government is going to force downgrades to encryption is pretty silly. That said, I know there are a lot of listeners to this podcast who don't really get much exposure to the guts of the national security establishment, and they're just super suspicious. Alasdair MacGibbon, our next guest, is very much enmeshed in the national security establishment. He's currently the Australian Prime Minister's cybersecurity advisor, but he also ran the high-tech crime centre for the Australian Federal Police many moons ago before doing a stint at eBay as its Director of Trust and Safety here in Australia. Funnily enough, about 10 minutes after we finished recording this interview, the government announced that Alasdair is to become the next director of the Australian Cyber Security Centre. It's a cross-agency centre that also collaborates with the private sector. So talking about this stuff, that's his bread and butter. I've known Alasdair for something like 14 years, and you know, covering this space as long as I have, we have been in each other's orbits for a while, I guess, and he kindly agreed to do this interview. We've done many, many interviews over the years, particularly during the print phase of my career. Now, during this interview, you'll hear him saying, I got some of his comments in the media wrong. The comments he's referring to are really when he went on television here and suggested that because companies like WhatsApp have advanced knowledge of unpatched bugs, this is an area where they can help. Now, I assumed he meant he wanted them to turn over bug information, but that's not the case, as you'll hear. Now, look, I do spend the first few minutes of this interview pushing him pretty hard on a fairly binary question about encryption, simply because that's what a bunch of very concerned people are very concerned about. But don't worry, it does eventually move on to other ground. So here is my interview with Alasdair MacGibbon. So, Alasdair MacGibbon, time is very limited. First question, does the Australian government want to break, weaken, or otherwise interfere with encryption technology?
What the Australian government's talking about, Patrick, is cooperating with industry and seeking industry cooperation. So, the most important thing is here, there's been no legislation put on the table, right? So, that's the important thing. An awful lot of speculation. A lot of shrill speculation too, I would say. The most important thing is at the G20, the 20 leaders that were at the G20, the most, you know, economically powerful nations in the world, all agreed that governments would work more closely with industry on helping address what is actually a problem, and that is the increasing ubiquity of encryption, especially as it's used by terrorists and criminals, people that no one likes. No one likes a terrorist. No one really likes criminals. So that's the issue that's being addressed, and it's about cooperating with industry and then, frankly, mandating that cooperation or creating a baseline for that cooperation. So industry knows where it stands and government knows where it stands.
Okay, sure. Now, look, it's all very well and good to say that the reaction has been hysterical, but you know, I just asked you a very direct question about whether or not this is about weakening encryption, and you kind of sidestepped it a little bit.
No, look. And I'm not intentionally doing that. What this is about is finding ways, practically, without seeing any silver bullets and accepting the fact that it's never going to be a perfect solution, to actually get industry that helped create these wonderful tools. And you're not going to get people more supportive of encryption than a government, frankly. I mean, we like encryption to protect our own systems. We like encryption to protect consumers. We like encryption to protect businesses. But life always has edge cases. There are always examples in the offline world and in the online world where those things that actually are good for the bulk of us are bad when they're used by a minority.
Sure, sure. So I guess the question becomes, is the way around that to actually demand a weakening of encryption standards or some sort of predefined curve that allows for cracking those communications easier? Or is the solution going to be more around asking technology companies to provide law enforcement with ways to access that data that don't involve weakening encryption? That's really the question that I have for you.
Well, I think most importantly is the government's not trying to be prescriptive on the how, and that's important. And again, that's not being evasive. That's saying, why should the government say how? What the government should say is what. And what the government wants, which is quite legitimate, is to be able to protect citizens against terrorists and criminals. And the way to protect the population against those people, when we're talking the online space, is assistance from companies, big companies that provide these services, just as we would have expected and do expect companies in the offline world to help government. Stuff done under warrant, scrutinised by the law, so that this isn't done on an ad hoc basis and it's not done on a flippant basis, that industry cooperates.
So I guess what you're saying is it's up to Apple or Facebook or whoever. You know, you say you want this data, and if they say, okay, well, we're going to weaken our encryption in order to get you that data, that's an acceptable outcome for the government. And if they decide, hey, we've got another way to do it that doesn't involve weakening encryption, that's okay too. So
I'm not talking about weakening encryption at all. What I'm talking about is these organisations helping. The organisations that build something are the most capable of working out how to comply with very reasonable expectations of government on protecting those very customers of those companies. Look, what I'd say to your listenership, who I, you know, love dearly and who clearly are going to love me dearly back,
yes,
and
of course.
I'm very fond of you, Patrick, is this. Hands up all of those people out there who've had search warrants executed upon their houses. Hands up how many of them have ever been dragged in by the police and asked questions.
This is an entirely reasonable thing to say.
The likelihood of this happening to any of those people is about the same. In other words, the vast bulk of us, me included, are going to go about our lives unhindered by this type of law. But the simple fact is there is always a break glass provision in a civil society that allows agencies, police and domestic security agencies, to do what would
sure.
be considered
Al,
egregious act.
I get what you're saying, right? But you're doing nothing to ameliorate the primary concern of the people who are jumping up and down over this, which is they're saying, if you want to demand weakened encryption, that's weakened encryption for everyone, and it impacts us all in a negative way. So, I mean, if you're talking about targeted assistance that doesn't involve weakening products that people rely on in their day-to-day lives, if you could just come out and say that, then...
Well, I'm not trying to be cute, but I'm not going to say anything in either direction. What I'm going to keep saying to you, Patrick, and if that leads people to come to other conclusions, that's fine, is this. Government has a reasonable expectation that industry, online and offline, will help protect the very citizens that help form the business that those businesses are in. And that's what we should all be doing, and that's an obligation of all businesses. I mean, I'd expect risky business to help, of course, and you would, if there was something that would help solve a crime or prevent a crime from happening, particularly if it was done under warrant. So I'm not going to talk about whether or not encryption gets weakened or encryption gets strengthened. We like encryption, as I've said. The Prime Minister likes encryption. We know he likes these very apps, right? I mean, he gets criticised for the fact that he likes these apps. He doesn't want to break anything. What he wants to do, quite rightly, because it's the number one responsibility of any government, is to protect its citizens. And simple facts are these. Go back 4 years and only 3% of the traffic that was intercepted by the Australian Federal Police and domestic security agencies was encrypted, and now the numbers are about 55 to 65%, depending on which agency, is encrypted. You draw a line on that and you can see that before too long they're not going to be able to listen in or read conversations. That might please some people, but it won't please the broader public, who frankly expect and need those agencies to be able to get into those communications.
Sure.
Again,
so let's ask
in a very targeted way.
Let's ask, what does, you know, you keep talking about reasonable expectations. What are the reasonable expectations at this time? Is it that you ask WhatsApp, hey, we need message data for this user, and then they just somehow procure it? Is it that, hey, Apple, we want access to this iPhone, they somehow have to give you a shell, you know, so that you can install some surveillance software on that device? Where is the limit here? What does assistance look like? How far do you want to push this?
Well, I'm a strong advocate for if the device is in the lawful possession of the police or a domestic security agency and they have a warrant to get into it, that they get into it. I thought the FBI v. Apple case, this is opening up a great wound, I'm sure, for your listenership again. I was clearly on the side of the FBI in that one. because that was a device that was
used. Well, so was I, Alf. Anyway, let's just put that out there.
No. And the point is, I thought Apple's response to that was really wrong. They could have helped. Now, people think that when they help an agency once, suddenly the cat's out of the bag and this can be used every time. Well, you know, the way I see it is, and we need to see what the legislation actually looks like. Of course, we're all speculating. I would hand the device over to whoever the company was and say, I don't care how you do it. In fact, I don't want to know how you do it. I just want you to tell me what information is on here. Particularly, I need the information that might relate to the scope of the network or any future attacks planned. These companies, and this is a classic red herring that gets put out by people in this discussion, that, oh my God, if they help get into that phone, then the secret has to be protected by those companies, and it'll eventually get out, and other naughty people are going to be using it. Well, these companies already know, which is why that I talked about unpatched things the other day, which have got conflated, by the way, including by you online, Patrick, but that's okay, is this. They know where vulnerabilities are because they're going to patch them in the next thing. So they might be able to use a vulnerability that they know about. They don't have to tell me
okay,
what it is.
Okay. Now I understand.
They just go out and extract it.
Okay, yeah. Now I understand. And thank you for putting that in there, because it saves me having to ask the question of what the hell were you talking about? Because that was...
it didn't get better at describing these
things. Yeah, it didn't come across precisely like that. Now, just to be clear, so you're saying that really this is less about mandating, blanket access regimes, and more about, well, hey, if you can assist, you should, not necessarily, hey, can you please re-engineer your products to suit the purposes of law enforcement?
Well, I think what we do is we start with the let's see where we can get to, right? So yeah. I'm not a politician. The politicians make those things, parliaments debate those laws. What I will say is the discussions I've had are about how do we make sure that we don't write off everything that happens online or on a piece of shiny tech to be outside of the bounds of law enforcement. Because again, I'm just going to go back to first principles here. Having executed search warrants on people's houses, that's a pretty egregious thing to do, of course, if that wasn't done under warrant. And yet the public expects the police to execute search warrants on people's houses. And again, to the individual, it's a very traumatic thing. But that's what we expect society to have in order to protect the broader society against individuals that are going to do harm. The same logic has to apply to our online activities and to the devices that we use. Again, a break glass provision used sparingly under great scrutiny. It's never going to be perfect, by the way. So that means from time to time, you're going to want to get into something or to hear something or to see something that you just can't hear or see. But you get pretty pragmatic if you're in this space. So you don't expect perfection. You don't expect silver bullets. Anyone peddling that on either side is wrong. So
would you agree that the eventual, where we're going to wind up, and I'm just going to push through this real quick because I know you got a hard stop that we just sailed past, very quickly, do you agree, like what I wrote the other day, do you agree that eventually we're heading down the road where governments are going to demand some sort of access, remote access to devices? I mean, because logically, if you're going to demand that tech companies do what you say, would you agree that this is eventually where we're going to wind up, maybe 5, 10, 15 years from now?
Look, I don't know, but what I would say is, and I took a calculated risk, of course, by saying I thought your article was good, because it was a level, not suddenly advertising for your blog here, Pat, but I actually thought it was a really level, smart way of looking at the problem. You addressed the issues methodically. You talked about some of the possibilities, but again, I'm going to go back to what I said at the start, and that is, I don't think we should prescribe anything at the moment. I think in terms of how, I think what we should say is establish a baseline of social expectation. Now, we're probably the worst people of all to talk about what the public, the average public person expects, because particularly in this industry, it can be pretty polarizing pretty quickly. But in my observation is that the public just wants to be as safe as possible, while having their privacy as much as they can. And I think we can achieve that. This is not a binary thing. It's not a surveillance state or a totally free, perfectly encrypted state. It is a a almost ubiquitous, it will be ubiquitous encryption that from time to time, depending on who you are and what you've done, won't be. It's very simple. How we make that unencrypted is the million-dollar question. We won't know that. I just think that that for far too long, though, companies have actually perpetuated a myth that they are above the law and beyond the remit of the broader society. And that's just not the case. They have a moral obligation, frankly, to meld to the laws of whatever country they're operating in. These same companies that will rail against this, Apple, for example, has just opened up its first, or will be soon opening its first data center in China to comply with the Chinese government law that says all iCloud and other data relating to Chinese citizens need to stay in China. I'm not sure if that's a privacy-enhancing move on the part of the Chinese government.
And yet, damn.
And yet that's exactly what China has demanded of Apple, and China and Apple has kowtowed to China on that. And yet a liberal Western democracy, a country that believes in the rule of law, is saying, hey, to protect our citizens against these most egregious criminals, Apple is railing against. And I'm not sure if that's a rational discussion. We need to sit down, we need to talk, and we need to make sure that they understand that they have moral and social obligations in every country they operate in.
Alistair McGibbon, thank you very much for your time. We'll leave it with those fighting words.
Cheers. Thanks, Patrick.
That was the Australian Prime Minister's cybersecurity advisor, Alistair McGibbon there. And big thanks to you, Alistair, for finding the time to do that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Tim Keeler of Remediant. We all know that privileged access management is an absolute pain in the ass. Even just figuring out where the privileged accounts live and who's using them, that can be a giant pain in the ass too. So Remediant, which is a small, highly specialized company, set out to do something about this. If you work in an authentication group, really, you know, you're going to probably quite enjoy this. Tim Keeler is the co-founder and chief executive of Remediant, and I asked him to tell me basically what they've developed. Here he is.
It's actually based off of a number of years that I spent as a security breach consultant, and I was helping a lot of enterprises deal with lots of different types of breaches. A lot of them were actually at the state-sponsored level, and you know, what we found is that the same attacks, you know, are hitting all the different enterprises in the exact same fashion, right? It's getting a phishing email to get a foothold into the network, starting to compromise some low-level endpoints, and then laterally move until you find some administrator that's logged into a system. And if that person has, you know, domain administrative rights, it's literally game over. And what we found, actually doing the breakdown of a lot of different breaches, is that companies are still struggling with some of the fundamentals of just understanding who has administrative rights in their entire company. And when we take a look at, you know, some of the complexities that we have with Active Directory, especially if you're dealing with, you know, very hierarchical structure and a lot of nested groups, it's really difficult just to understand who has administrative rights to what systems, right? Because every system can have different set of administrators. And if you add a new user to a group, you might inherit permissions four tiers up that you never really intended. And companies are struggling with that. So that was kind of the first challenge we wanted to tackle, is let's give them visibility, because you're not going to be successful with security unless you have that visibility and understand, you know, what admins you're actually trying to protect. And, you know, the second part of that is, well, now that we have visibility into all the different administrators, let's just be more intelligent about how administrators get access to systems. And really what we decided to do is take a step back and rethink, because a lot of the companies were investing in, you know, privileged access management tools, and they were just having real struggles implementing that successfully in the organization. And when we took a look at what administrators do on a day-to-day basis, they're only logging into a small handful of systems when the level of access that their account has is literally 24/7 access to tens of thousands of systems, if not more and larger environments. So what we wanted to do is introduce this new concept of just-in-time administration. And really what that allows users to do is get dynamic time-based access to various systems that they need in order to do their day-to-day job.
I want to get onto that, right? But I mean, it's funny because we've seen tools that provide or claim to provide visibility into where your privileged accounts are, right? So, I mean, a lot of them are kind of you know, the output is difficult to parse, shall we say? You know what I mean? So it's like, it's, that's more of a like data visualization problem and a, you know, ordering of data problem, right? Because collecting information on accounts isn't tremendously difficult, right? It's like, how do you display that to an administrator in a way that sort of makes sense and actually helps them make better decisions? So that's a problem that we're familiar with. But the idea of just-in-time sort of access, you know, on-the-fly administrator access, there are some companies that do, like, who take the password vault approach, which I'm guessing, yeah. Is that at all similar to what you're doing?
Yeah, we've actually stepped aside from the whole password vault because that was really where companies, you know, were struggling to have successful implementation. And administrators are really creative, so they find ways around the password vault. And there's generally a big disconnect between what the security team thinks needs to be in the password vault and then where the outlying administrative privilege exists.
I think what you're trying to say is the development teams don't use it.
Oh yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's extremely frustrating for them to use, and they just want to be able to do their job. And when they have to jump through many hoops, by logging into a password vault, checking out an alternate set of credentials, or logging through a jump station, it's just counterproductive to the business. And that's really been the kind of the core challenge in security when you're trying to tighten administrative rights, because everyone thinks, oh, the security team just wants to take all of my admin access or rights. But I'm just trying to get my job done. And so what we really wanted to do is, okay, let's forget about password vaults and bifurcating identities even further. We'll just create a really simple interface where administrators can log in with two-factor authentication and just say, hey, I need access to server A or server B. And then you can log on and do your job, whether it's for 4 hours or 8 hours or however long you need access to that particular system.
Okay. So walk us through that process though, because I'm not sure that I completely understand it, and I'm not sure listeners will either. So, how are you actually provisioning administrator access to boxes in a way that's better than how it's already done? Just walk us through it.
Sure. So, when a system gets put into protect mode, what we've actually done is inventoried all of the administrators on that particular system, and when protect mode is enabled, we simply take all of those administrators out of the local admin group. So that system is actually in a fully locked down state where nobody can log in directly to that system with full administrative access. So then what we do is we introduce the web interfaces, and this is where the two-factor authentication bit comes in. And it's really easy for the administrator. They simply just type in the name of the system that they need to access, and SecureOne verifies, hey, that's someone who should have administrative rights to that system. And then that administrator just types, hey, give me access to the system. So we'll take his Active Directory account and put it into the local admin group. So now that administrator has the ability to log onto that particular server. And, you know, let's say we have a 4-hour window.
So it's almost like you have to go through your web interface thing just to basically turn the access on for a little bit. So it is an extra step, but it's not necessarily as fiddly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Right. We want to make it super easy. And this kind of comes into some of the design patterns that we're really thinking about is make it super easy for the administrators to do. So it's not going to be a barrier for them to do their job. And, you know, make sure we have just a very clean, intuitive web interface in order to do that. And make it really easy for the security to be able to understand who has administrative access and exactly what they're doing and what administrators are logging onto different systems.
Now, I'm guessing you've done an absolute buttload of pen testing on that web interface, because I'm thinking that looks like a pretty decent target, because it's got, you know, very privileged access itself to absolutely everything, right? Because it can start, I'm guessing if it can, you know, if it can add permissions to accounts, I'm guessing, yeah, it itself is pretty privileged, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so we do a couple of things to kind of minimize the amount of risk is we use a locally provisioned service account on each of the different endpoints. We do this all without agents, so it makes, you know, kind of deployment very rapid in these environments. And then having unique credentials on each different account has, kind of reduces the risk of a single account getting exposed and being able to log into other systems.
And so, what about the actual risk your system, your web application itself?
Yeah, you nailed it right there. We've gone through some very extensive pen tests, and actually one of our largest customers, Lockheed Martin, has done. You know, they stick their red team all over our product, and we are very pleasantly surprised to come out with their findings. Because these guys take security very seriously, obviously.
So you didn't find, they didn't find much. That's, yeah, you would have been sweating that test, I'm guessing, at the time.
Yeah, right. I mean, we operate as a hardened Linux appliance. And when we minimize the entry points in the box, you actually get a lot of security benefits, right? If the only way to go through and gain access is through your web interface, and, you know, you're following all the fundamentals around web application security and making sure things are up to date, you know, that's a much lower risk than all these other vulnerabilities that you see just at the mass operating system level, right?
Yeah. Do you actually get SSH access to that box as well, or is it just all through the web app?
We do it all through the web app. We do have a kind of a maintenance account that we use for SSH access, but nobody ever typically uses that.
Yeah, right. Because, yeah, I mean, it would be a bit of a bummer if Apache went down and yeah, you right. don't have any other way to access it, right? So, you know, right, there is right. that. Now, you guys are a pretty new company. What's the plan in terms of like who, I'm guessing there's just going to be like authentication groups in large companies who are going to be interested in this. Is that the intended market, or is it intended to come a little bit down into the SME space?
You know, kind of our core focus is on enterprises because as we kind of, you know, see the unraveling of a lot of different breaches, these companies are still struggling with administrator over-provisioning. You know, they're dealing with very large, complex IT environments, and, you know, they're just trying to get to a good understanding of all these different, you know, business units and groups that have IT admin privilege, but they don't really have that full visibility into that. So it's like, okay, let's give them that visibility into it, and then we can actually, you know, start introducing protect mode where it's just really easy to adopt kind of this philosophy of zero privilege and then letting administrators kind of self-service themselves to get access to various systems. So it's all about scale and rapid deployment for us.
All right, Tim Keeler, thank you very much for coming onto the show to have a bit of a chat about the stuff you've developed, Remediant. It does sound interesting. And you know, what I like about doing these sponsor interviews is often we get, you know, a vendor onto the show with a relatively new idea and we do get some pretty good feedback from people who, you know, work in those authentication groups and whatnot. So I'll be looking forward to hearing what people say. But thank you very much for joining us, and thanks for sponsoring this week's episode.
Thanks a lot, Patrick.
That was Tim Keeler there of Remediant. You can check them out at remediant.com. That's remediant.com. And that is it for this week's show. So until 2 weeks from now, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.